good writing on happiness. To riff on a famous Tolstoy quote, we have a great many novels about unhappy families, but none that I can think of about a happy one. But Dickens is the exception, according to Orwell. He claims the great novelist dealt with the happiness theme successfully in the Pickwick Papers and A Christmas Carol. Given the Christmas theme of the column, Orwell focuses on the latter story, claiming it tells us something important about the nature of happiness. Specifically, and again I'm quoting, the Cratchit family give the impression of enjoying themselves. You remember the Cratchits, Tiny Tim. They sound happy as, for instance, the citizens of William Morris's Muse from Nowhere don't sound happy. They are in high spirits because for once in a way they have enough to eat. The wolf is at the door, but he is wagging his tail. The steam of the Christmas pudding drifts across a background of pawn shops and sweated labor, and in a double sense, the ghost of Scrooge stands beside the dinner table, unquote. I think that's beautifully written, and Orwell goes on to make the point that the secret of Dickens being able to present happiness convincingly is that happiness derives, quote, mainly from the contrast. The Cratchits are able to enjoy Christmas precisely because it only comes once a year. So it is the contrast that is crucial, because the Christmas pudding gets served up against the background of social misery, because it is such a brief respite from the relentless need to scratch out a living. There is an intensity of delight in the pudding, and of course the whole meal, that it otherwise wouldn't have. In other words, the more incomplete and tenuous the portrayal of happiness, the more believable it is. But what happens when you eliminate the contrast, when you take Scrooge and Scroogism out of the picture? This brings Orwell to utopian fiction. This hence his reference to William Morris's utopia, Muse from Nowhere. Given that Orwell wrote the best-known dystopian books of the last century, Animal Farm and 1984, it's not exactly surprising to find that he is underwhelmed by utopian writing. He states flatly, quote, all efforts to describe permanent happiness have been failures. That they are, quote, invariably unappetizing and usually lacking in vitality as well. He faults utopian fiction for postulating perfection while being unable to suggest happiness. In Muse from Nowhere, quote, everyone is kindly and reasonable, but the impression left behind is of a sort of watery melancholy, which is, I think, a lovely phrase. It's not much different in the sci-fi utopias of H.G. Wells, and even a much greater writer, Jonathan Swift, goes flat when he enters utopian territory. In the section on the Wynnums and Gulliver's Travels, the lives of these supremely reasonable creatures, I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but they're horses with a very high intelligence, seem to be, according to Orwell, chiefly concerned with avoiding fuss. They are remarkably dreary and lead a tepid sort of existence, free of disorder and insecurity, but also free of any passion. Orwell is just as unimpressed by religious visions. He writes, heaven is as great a flop as utopia, though hell occupies a respectable place in literature. And I think anyone familiar with Dante would agree with that. Words like ecstasy and bliss that commonly figure in descriptions of paradise are usually just metaphors of vacuousness. If we descend from heaven and focus solely on earthly delights and imagine a world where, as it were, Christmas comes every day, for instance, in the hobo's paradise sung about in the folk tune The Big Rock Candy Mountains, this too Orwell finds unconvincing, an endless round of feasting, drinking, hunting, and lovemaking. Who would not sicken of such an existence after a few months? So, dreams of happiness, Orwell argues, change over time. And those changes are conditioned by the historical context, particularly class oppression and material scarcity. But as soon as you take those dreams and fix them as an eternal utopia, the dream goes stale. And here's a quote from Orwell, actually I think the best known quote from this particular essay. Nearly all creators of utopia have resembled the man who has a toothache and who therefore thinks happiness consists in not having a toothache. They want to produce a perfect society and an endless continuation of something that had only been valuable because it was temporary. Okay, that brings me back to Orwell's initial questions. Can socialists be happy? I need a drink of water, drink of something before I go on with that. Taken literally, this is, I think, a silly question. Socialists aren't any more averse to happiness than anyone else. But this isn't what Orwell is on about. The issue isn't whether socialists can be happy, but rather whether socialism should be about happiness. It is this that Orwell answers in the negative, and he writes, "I suggest that the real objective of socialism is not happiness. Happiness hitherto has been a byproduct, and for all we know it may always remain so. The real objective of socialism is human brotherhood. This is widely felt to be the case, though it is not usually said or not said loudly enough. Men use up their lives in heartbreaking political struggles, or get themselves killed in civil wars, or tortured in the secret prisons of the Gestapo, not in order to establish some central heated, air-conditioned, strip-lighted paradise, but because they want a world in which human beings love one another instead of swindling and murdering one another. And they want that world as a first step. Where they go from there is not so certain, and the attempt to foresee it in detail merely confuses the issue." It's hard not to like Orwell. He presents sound ideas in an admirably clear and eloquent way, and it's evident that these ideas meant more to him than just fodder for a newspaper column. In the remark about a central heated, air-conditioned, strip-lighted paradise, there is a foreshadowing of 1984, written 5 years later. Indeed, I would say the whole essay is such a foreshadowing. In any case, anyone who has studied the utopian tradition will find much to agree with in Orwell's ideas. Still, a lot has changed since 1943. For us, to a far greater extent than for Orwell, it is crucial to distinguish between a criticism from the left of the shortcomings of utopianism versus an attack on this tradition from the right, or make that an onslaught from the right. It has been widely argued, perhaps most cogently, by Russell Jacoby in his book, The End of Utopia, that we live in a world where utopia has virtually disappeared from public discourse, in mainstream political life, and even in much of what constitutes the radical fringe. In an essay called Utopia and Its Discontents, written in 2003, by longtime New York Times writer Edward Rothstein, we get the following remarks that are typical of the prevailing zeitgeist. Quote, "The last century's worst horrors, including Nazi Germany, the Soviet regime, the Maoist Cultural Revolution, grew out of utopian visions. With such examples in mind, the philosopher Isaiah Berlin argued that utopianism leads not to freedom, but to tyranny. He regularly invoked Kant in reproof." And this is a quote from Kant. "Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made," unquote. The philosopher Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies wrote that those who envision making heaven on earth will only succeed in making it hell, unquote. I assume that anyone attending a lecture